It's 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Nigeria's president meets with family members of abducted schoolgirls. CAR peace talks in Congo Brazzaville are suspended. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. In Nigeria, Reuters quotes witnesses and security sources as saying the capture of an army base and massacres aimed at civilians in neighboring villages have left the Islamist group Boko Haram in effective control of large parts of the country's northeast. The raids have displaced thousands. President Goodluck Jonathan Tuesday met in Abuja with parents of more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants in April. More than 150 took part in Tuesday's meeting, including some of the girls who managed to escape from their abductors. Afterwards, presidential spokesman Ruben Abati said the meeting was frank and the participants spoke their minds to the Nigerian leader.
The president has been looking for an opportunity to sit down together, you know, with the parents directly and with the girls themselves, the ones that have escaped, to reassure them of the government's commitment, to empathize with them and to, you know, bring them up to date about the efforts being made by the administration to ensure that the girls are brought back home safely.
He said security agencies have credible information about where the militants are keeping the girls but declined to provide specifics. President Jonathan has been under criticism by some of the schoolgirls' parents for failing to meet with him until now and for the perceived slow pace of his government's investigation of the abduction. Later today, the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, which has been rallying for the schoolgirls' release, will hold events across the country to mark the 100th day of their captivity. Peace talks between the government of Central African Republic and rebels have been suspended after the main rebel group failed to show up for a second day of the three-day meeting. The talks in the neighboring Republic of Congo were put on hold due to the absence of former Salika rebels. Monday, Salika leader Musa Dafani said a partition is needed in the CAR before the mostly Muslim group can hold talks with mostly Christian anti-Balaka militants. He called for the CAR to be divided into a Muslim north and a Christian south. Meanwhile, relief organizations estimate that at least 2,000 people have been killed in CAR's unrest. More than a million have been displaced. The UN Refugee Agency says a lack of funding has made it unable to provide relief aid to tens of thousands of CAR refugees, Lisa Schlein reports.
UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch tells VOA refugees continue to flee the Central African Republic at a rate of about 2,000 a week. He says most of them head for Cameroon.
People that we have been receiving inside Cameroon, they have been working for days, weeks, and months. And especially when they arrive, many of these are going through phases of malnutrition, but especially kids. They just, when they arrive, they come to die at our doorsteps in that sense. So it's a very dire situation.
Baluch says interest in the CAR refugees has dropped significantly since images of their desperate plight have disappeared from television screens. He calls the Central African Republic a forgotten crisis and says this is having severe repercussions.
It seriously hampers our efforts.
Baluch says greater efforts must be made to relocate people away from insecure and remote locations that often are hard to reach. He says more sites need to be established to ensure refugee safety. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Gunmen attacked a military camp in Democratic Republic of Congo's capital Tuesday, but the government says the situation is now under control. In an interview with VOA, government spokesman Lambert Mendez said a small band of attackers tried to enter Camp Shachi in Kinshasa, but were stopped. He said authorities have not yet determined whether the attackers were terrorists or thieves. Gunmen loyal to an evangelical Christian pastor who is opposed to President Joseph Kabila assaulted the same base and briefly captured the state television station in December last year. The government said more than 100 people were killed as its forces repelled those attacks. Political tensions are on the rise in DRC amid speculation Mr. Kabila will try to change the constitution and run for a third term in office. South Sudanese rebels in Kampala to urge Uganda to withdraw its troops from the country left without meeting President Yoweri Museveni. A Ugandan foreign ministry official said a meeting was planned for Tuesday, but the rebel delegation left after no one met them at the airport. Uganda has backed the South Sudanese government in their fight against rebels, which erupted in December. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has met the families of the kidnapped schoolgirls.
The meeting was frank, it was open, it was interactive. Mr. President invited, all of the people present to say their minds, and they spoke their minds.
Rumi Abate is the spokesman for President Jonathan. The U.S. Embassy is training Nigerian electoral workers. Activists called on Gambia's government to improve its human rights record. A Zimbabwe court strikes down a law which makes defamation a crime. And could South Africa's latest strike be coming to an end soon?
10%, I think, is what we have been looking for, a double-digit settlement. And workers, I'm sure that they will be willing to accept that. But if employers want the strike to come to an end, they should not tamper with Section 37.
Vuyo Lufele is the Secretary General for NAMSA Western Cape Province, and a new VOA documentary focuses on the stigma of AIDS. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Parents of the more than 200 girls kidnapped from northern Nigeria met Tuesday with President Goodluck Jonathan to express their grief. As Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from Abuja, local doctors say the kidnapping and continued terror attacks have psychologically devastated families in the region.
Tensions are high at Nigeria's presidential office, known locally as the Villa, as four shiny red buses pull into secured gates. The buses carry about 200 residents of Chibok, mostly parents of girls kidnapped in April by Boko Haram militants. There are also more than 50 girls who escaped the militants shortly after their abduction. Presidential spokesman Ruben Abadi says the families had a formal closed-door meeting with Mr. Jonathan in the villa.
The meeting was frank, it was open, it was interactive. Mr. President invited, all of the people present to say their minds, and they spoke their minds.
Abadi told journalists they are not permitted to speak to the Chibok parents or girls because it is a controlled program. The president, he says, repeated his promise to find the girls, a promise that has been repeated many times since they were kidnapped more than 3 months ago. Abadi also denies reports that Damboa, an area that neighbors Chibok, has been overrun by Boko Haram militants who reportedly hoisted black flags over towns after killing more than 100 residents and burning homes over the weekend.
Mr. President's primary concern is one to ensure the release of the girls, and also secondly to defend the integrity of the Nigerian state. And that is why, the operation against terror is a continuous one, is a determined one, and no part of Nigeria will be allowed to be overtaken by terrorists.
Doctors say terror is a mainstay of everyday life for the Chibok families, and as the nightmare drags on, psychological damage deepens within the community. Dr. Denladi Seladrissa says he is personally aware of at least four of the kidnapped girls' parents being killed by Boko Haram since the abductions. Others have reported 11 deaths of parents, making things worse for the community now and for the girls if they are ever rescued.
The problem is overwhelming, and the support is very limited for now. But we want to believe that before time runs out, more hands will come into, and then we are going to have a proper counseling team that will help the community.
He says grief counselors have been trained to help the community cope, but Boko Haram attacks have prevented those outside Chibok from moving in. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The U.S. Embassy in Nigeria is organizing a series of workshops to train public affairs officers of the Independent National Electoral Commission, known as INEC, to prepare them for interaction with stakeholders in the run-up to next year's general election. Nick Dazan, INEC's National Deputy Director for Public Affairs, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the training will help the commission in its engagement with civil society organizations and the voters.
We started the first leg of this training in Lagos at the Lagos Consulate on the 18th And we started the second leg of the same training for the public affairs officers in the northern part of the country yesterday, and we are going to end the training on the 25th of this month. That is on Friday.
How will this be beneficial to Electoral Commission officials ahead of next year's general election?
It will be of tremendous value to the commission in the sense that, one, the public affairs officers will be in a position to do their jobs more confidently and more competently than they used to do before. The kind of training that we were exposed to by especially the lead facilitator, that is Darwin Johnson, was such that it exposed our public affairs officers as to how they can write press releases, as to how they can organize press conferences, as to how they can conduct these press conferences, and as to how they can communicate effectively with stakeholders. As you know, between now and the 2015 general elections, we are going to do a lot of communicating with stakeholders, especially the political parties, the media, civil society organizations, and the voters themselves.
How will this have an impact on the negative perception of Nigerian prospective voters of the Commission's ability to organize credible vote in next year's elections?
Generally, a matter of perception. The fact that the EMB itself has to be seen to be up and doing and conduct elections that are credible, that are fair, and that are transparent. Nigerians also need, and the members of the international community also need, to see these elections are truly transparent. And it is the public affairs officers that can help the EMB to project ANEC as an organization that is determined and irrevocably resolved to conducting elections that are free and fair.
Nick Dazan is a National Deputy Director for Public Affairs of INEC. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Activists across West Africa held protests on Tuesday on the 20th anniversary of President Yahya Jammeh's seizure of power to raise awareness about what they call Gambia's dire human rights situation. Human rights groups are demanding the Gambian government put an end to alleged repression, torture, and forced disappearances. Jennifer Lazuta has more from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
Human rights, Gambia! Human rights, Gambia!
Dozens of protesters gathered outside the Gambian embassy in Senegal's capital to, in their words, raise awareness about ongoing human rights violations in Gambia. Activists in other cities are calling for the Gambian government to revoke laws they say have led to a culture of intimidation, harassment, and detention over the past 20 years. Fatou Diagne is the director of Article 19, an international organization that advocates for freedom of expression and access to information.
We are here to denounce 20 years of oppression, 20 years of lack of freedom in the Gambia, but also to show a sign of solidarity on all the victims of human rights violations, especially those who have lost their lives, those who disappeared also, and those who have been tortured, maltreated, and those who just lost their freedom, who are in prison for just wanting to be part of the way their countries have been run, and those who wanted just to express their views.
The Gambian government has previously denounced what it calls a relentless smear campaign against its human rights record. In a statement in October 2013, it said Gambia's enemies have set up organizations to spread lies and make what it called false, outrageous, and unfounded statements about the state of human rights in the country. But many Gambians say they have been subjected to years of oppression and fear since the 1994 military coup that brought President Yahya Jammeh to power. President Jammeh reinstated the death penalty and enacted restrictive freedom of expression laws, which, according to human rights defenders, are so vague that they can be used to charge anyone who expresses any sort of dissent. Amnesty International, which has documented the unpublicized executions of death row inmates and torture of human rights activists in Gambia, say it is time for things to change. Francois Pachuel is Amnesty International's West Africa campaigner.
And we are really calling for the international community and the government of Senegal, but also the government of Gambia, to put an end to this regime of fear by, repealing legal provisions in the criminal code which are used to restrict dissent, release political prisoners, and to hold perpetrators of human rights violations to account and bring them to justice.
Protesters gathered Tuesday in countries such as Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, Mali, Ghana, Togo, Senegal, and Sierra Leone to express solidarity with the Gambian Rights Campaign. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Today's Wednesday, July 23rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The Constitutional Court of Zimbabwe on Tuesday struck down a section of the hated law which makes defamation a criminal offense. The case was brought by the Zimbabwe Independent newspaper and its staffers. In his decision, Justice Luke Malaba said the law breached freedom of expression. Lofty Dube of the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe says there's need to repeal or align most media laws in Zimbabwe with the country's new constitution.
What the Constitutional Court has just done is to confirm what the Zimbabweans have been saying in the last 34 years, that criminal defamation has no place in a democracy, and we expect Zimbabwe to be a democracy, and we expect the country not to conform to things like criminal defamation. And what that means is that we shall not want to see the police going around picking from these statutes that have not been realigned with the Constitution. We hope they will not start going to some of these laws and picking specifics. So that might bring criminal defamation through the back door.
Obviously, this is a milestone, Mr. Dube, but journalists still worry about other hostile pieces of legislation, such as the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, as well as the Public Order and Security Act.
If you look at our new constitution, if you look at Section 61 and 62, we talk about freedom of expression and access to information. These laws, if you apply the constitution to the current laws that we have, a lot of laws will need to be amended or repealed or aligned with the new constitution. And when that happens, we then are going to have a scenario where the freedom of the media will be guaranteed, where bad laws such as IPA, POSTA, Official Secrets Act, the Criminal Procedures Act, as the new Secretary General, will not be used, because they will then conform to the constitution. And as a result, they cannot be used against, because they will be altered via the constitution.
That's Lofty Dube of the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with reporter Untungamile Nkomo of VOA's Zimbabwe service. The National Union of Mental Workers of South Africa, known as NAMSA, the country's largest labor union, is considering employers' latest offer aimed at ending a three-week-old strike in the country's steel and engineering sector. At the intervention of the Labour Ministry, the Steel and Engineering Federation of Southern Africa, SAFSA, agreed on Tuesday to increase by 10% the salaries of three categories of workers over the next 3 years. Vuyo Lufele, Secretary General for NAMSA in Western Cape Province, says the workers have long wanted a double-digit wage increase and are likely to accept the 10% offer. But Vuyo tells me that if the employers want the strike to end, they should drop their demand to amend Section 37 of the Collective Bargaining Agreement.
Employers have offered finally 10% for 3 years. And that applied mostly on the lowest paid. It's going to be 10% for this year, 10% next year, and 10% the third. But now they've done that with the conditions attached. If you remember, there is a Section 37 of our collective agreement, which states that if agreement had been signed, then for the duration of the agreement, no trade union would be allowed to negotiate on anything that is part of the collective agreement. And that's where NUMSA members have said they will fight tooth and nail until they die for that one. And the employers are saying they are waiting until Friday to hear from us, putting threats that they will take back what is the offer currently if we do not agree until Friday. And we are saying, look, as NUMSA, the employers, if they are not willing to concede to that demand or to leave Section 37, the strike will continue.
Does this latest 10%, does it cover majority of the workers?
This 10% covers majority of our members, because from the first year, grade F, G, and H will get 10%. And on the second year, grade G and H will get 10%. And then on the third year, grade H will get 10%.
And that is where majority of our members you will find in the industry. But this is a proposed agreement that is coming from the Department of Labor and the facilitator. And employers are willing to give to the workers, but with the condition that workers give away Section 37.
Has there been violence connected with the strike? Are your members involved in any violent act since the strike began?
Yeah, I can say that from our side, we have not registered violence, but employers are complaining of violence and intimidation and so on and so on. But it's something that we condemn if such exists, although we have not registered such, but we condemn if there is such things.
So will you look ahead to Friday? What do you think the union is going to come up with? Are they going to accept the 10% or not?
Depending on the workers, 10% I think is what we have been looking for, a double-digit settlement. And workers, I'm sure that they will be willing to accept that. But if employers want the strike to come to an end, they should not tamper with Section 37.
Vuyo Lufele is the Secretary General for NAMSA Western Cape Province. He was speaking with me from Cape Town. Despite major medical advances in treating AIDS, one powerful force stands in the way of treatment for many afflicted with the disease, stigma. A special Voice of America documentary, Living in the Shadows, pulled back the curtain on this challenge in the fight against AIDS. VOA's Anita Powell attended the screening, and she brings us this report from the 20th International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia.
Stigma has stuck to AIDS from the very start. When the virus first began to emerge in the 1980s, it cut a wide swath through two groups that have historically faced their own stigma, gay men and intravenous drug users. More than 30 years later, however, the face of AIDS has changed. Today's new HIV patient is statistically likely to be a heterosexual African woman. But as VOA's new documentary, Living in the Shadows, shows, as the reach of AIDS has expanded, stigma remains and seems as stubborn as this highly adaptable virus. AIDS stigma remains from Cambodia to Nigeria to Uganda. It even persists in 2014 in developed nations like the U.S. and Canada, says immunologist Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Fauci noted the powerful role of stigma in discussing the famous recent case of the Mississippi baby, a baby born with HIV contracted from her mother, then treated aggressively and put in remission for just over 2 years before again showing signs of infection. The baby's mother, he said, did not get prenatal care that would have identified her HIV status and protected the baby from contracting the virus. That failure to get care, he said, is often a consequence of stigma.
In the United States, a developed nation, there is still, as shown on the film, even in the city that I live in, considerable stigma associated with it, some of which is very subtle, that prevents people from getting into the appropriate care at the appropriate time. So there's a lot of implications of that.
In Nigeria, where it's against the law to be gay, gay rights activist Afani Kelly Orazulike painted a dark picture of the stigma around AIDS and homosexuality.
It's incredibly amazing how we have lived through the work that we do in Nigeria and how we have been able to survive in terms of ensuring that people have access to healthcare services and access to social justice, because living by the day gets more scarier than it was the previous day.
And AIDS stigma affects not just patients, but their providers as well. Dr. Julio Montaner has worked in the field for decades and says that stigma could be holding back important advances. He described, for example, his struggles in getting government approval to set up a safe needle exchange site for drug users in Vancouver, Canada.
Yet we suffer stigma by association. And, you know, I don't see too many times when my friend, who is a cardiologist, gets asked, why do you do this work? What motivates you to do this work? Why are you so passionate about it? I mean, people accept that being a cardiologist, you're supposed to be passionate about cardiac disease. But we get asked that all the time. You know, how the hell do you care about people who use drugs? And, you know, and this and that and the other thing.
Montana does not offer an answer to that question. Why, he said, should he have to explain himself any more than any other doctor treating any other disease? That's one of the many questions that haunts this deadly virus and continues to plague the fight against AIDS. Anita Powell, VOA News, Melbourne, Australia.
25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting, here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Tunisia's under-23 team pipped their peers and hosts Qatar by a solitary goal in Doha on Tuesday. The two sides are gearing up for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympic football qualifiers. Meanwhile, the Algerian national football team players have donated United States dollars 100,000 to help alleviate the suffering of children in Gaza Strip in Palestine, the Algeria Football Federation revealed in Algiers. The children are trapped in the crossfire between the Israeli army and Hamas militants in over 2 weeks of fierce fighting in the Gaza Strip. The Algerian players noted that fans in Gaza supported Algeria's campaign during the recent FIFA World Cup in Brazil, where Africa's highest-placed nation on the FIFA rankings progressed beyond the group stage for the first time in four outings to the World Cup. In athletics, Nigeria's Bashiru Abdallah and Ghana's Yakubu Ibrahim each set their respective national junior men's 110-meter hurdles records on the opening day at the IAAF World Junior Athletics Championships in Eugene, Oregon State in the United States of America on Tuesday. Abdullahi clocked 14.04 seconds, while Ibrahim ran 14.61 seconds. Later, Mzamo Mgomezulu set a Swaziland junior men's 100-meter record of 10.84 seconds. Finally, 18 African nations are among 71 countries and territories that have converged in Glasgow, Scotland for the 2014 British Commonwealth Games. African teams that will file through the opening ceremony today, Wednesday, are Botswana, Cameroon, Ghana, Lesotho, Kenya, Malawi, Mauritius, Mozambique, and Namibia. Others are Nigeria, Rwanda, Seychelles, Sierra Leone, South Africa, Swaziland, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia. Over the next 10 days, sportsmen and women are vying for medals in athletics, badminton, boxing, cycling, diving, gymnastics, hockey, judo, lawn bowls, netball, powerlifting, rugby, shooting, squash, swimming, triathlon, table tennis, weightlifting, and wrestling. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Wednesday morning comes from Mohamed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia. He says, "Dear VOA, I call on President Salva Kiir of South Sudan to give peace a chance. Accusing his former vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, of corruption is absurd and untimely. I think the president should have first instituted an inquiry if he thought Dr. Machar was complicit in corruption. I am of the conviction that President Kiir's accusation is another attempt to undermine the ongoing peace negotiations." We thank you, Mohamed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Gunmen attacked a military camp in the Democratic Republic of Congo's capital on Tuesday, but the government says the situation was quickly brought under control. In an interview with VOA's French to Africa service, government spokesman Lambert Mende said a small band of attackers tried to enter Camp Shashi in Kinshasa, but were stopped. And Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has met with parents of some of the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants in April. That's it for this Wednesday, July 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Botti saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.